This is WGRE 91.5 FM, Greencastle, Indiana.
Good evening and welcome to Music for Life, music from DePauw. This week, we hear from piano professor Mei Pong about her upcoming solo recital program. Artists in residence Melissa and Eric Snoza from Fifth House Ensemble stop by the studio to tell us about their most recent campus visit. We share some gems from recent performances on our stages. And we have a Green guest artist doubleheader this month, cutting-edge string quartet Ethel and their special guest Native American musician Robert Mirabal talk to us about their lives and work as 21st century musicians. There are lots of exciting things going on in the DePauw School of Music, and we're glad you could join us for Music for Life. On Monday, October 6th, at 7:30 p.m. in Thompson Recital Hall, the incomparable Mei Pong comes to perform again. She always loves it when I embarrass her on the radio by telling her how much I love her playing. We're thrilled to have her here, and...
You know, this pressure, it's not good. Okay, sorry.
So, tell us, Mei, what will you be performing for us?
There will be a late Schubert sonata.
So you're going to open up with Schubert?
Yes. And then the second half of the program is a piece, Fantasy Choruses on This Little Light of Mine.
Really?
By Kurt Cacioppo.
You always play the most fantastic pieces, and oftentimes things I've never heard, but how do you find them?
Work.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of artists today use YouTube, different catalog listings, follow on Amazon. There's all kinds of ways to find out what's happening in the new literature world, but how do you do it?
You know, it's very hard because there is so much literature, especially for the piano.
Mm-hmm.
And so thus the Schubert, there's these masterworks that one feels one needs to try one's hand at. And then there's, I feel like with being a 21st century musician, one should play the classical music of today.
Right, exactly.
And part of it is my love for the masterpieces of the mm-hmm. past, because one, especially as a pianist, there is such a rich tradition that I feel mm-hmm. we should not just go to the new and just throw away all that.
Right.
So anyway, this work is inspired by Beethoven's Choral Fantasy.
Wow.
But the theme being This Little Light of mm-hmm. Mine. And so we have the vernacular.
That is so cool.
And it's also written in such a contrapuntal style, which I love contrapuntal music. But then that makes it so difficult.
Yes. Yes. So when was this piece written?
2007.
So it's relatively new.
Yes.
It's cutting edge by classical music standards. So you would categorize this as a very challenging work?
Yes. The composer himself, he's a virtuoso pianist, so he plays a lot of his own music.
Ah.
Then there's that other pressure, because then, oh no, what is he going to think of the way, yeah.
And so where did you find this particular work?
I don't actually remember.
Because
I was actually doing some research on, this is completely off track again.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it or not, Native American music.
Really?
For some reason, I don't know why I decided, well, you know, I'm just going to go.
Well, you know, we're talking about that this semester.
No, and that's why with Joseph Horowitz coming with the Dvorak Festival, I was thinking, oh, wow, that's how I found out about Farwell.
Uh-huh.
Anyway,
Kurt
Cacioppo is interested also in Native American writing in that vein.
How about that? So we as a music school are looking at two Native American opportunities. One last week when we had the Ethel String Quartet and Robert Mirabal, and then also with the Joe Horowitz Dvorak Festival, where we've sent you some music of Farwell that your students are putting together.
Yeah, no, and that's why I thought, oh, wow, had I known about this sooner, you know?
And, you know, that's what's always so interesting about you for me, is that you'll discover a piece and perform it the next week. I mean, you know, most pianists will spend forever trying, and you go to town on a piece and learn it so quickly. So tell us the truth. How long have you had this piece?
No, this will be heard by students whom we encourage to be more prepared about things. No, I really cannot help it. That's why I take a long time to decide on a program, because mm-hmm. I'm always kind of looking for things that might fit better or match whatever else I'm playing on a program.
Right.
And there are so many choices. There really are.
Right. So especially for a pianist. Yeah. So, and you know, you have big ears. You're out listening to music and finding new stuff all the time, and then it excites you, and it's like, well,
exactly.
I gotta play that.
And so I thought I had settled on programming, and the next moment you like, oh,
throw
you
that
know,
right
there's
out the
that. Or no, sometimes it's not. It's something. Sometimes it's really prosaic. It's like you ordered the music, and it still hasn't arrived by a certain date, and then you figured I need to
move on,
do something
right,
else
right,
or
right.
things like that.
Well, this is a remarkably exciting program. Schubert on the first half. Brand new work on the second half. That kind of ties into our theme, and that there's still another piece on this program.
Yes, this is our new take on the very famous 24th Caprice of Paganini.
Ooh.
So these are variations on a theme of Paganini by Alexander Rosenblatt. Mm. And I'm trying my hand at something new. It's basically a jazzed up version of it.
Wow. Now that sounds really
so
exciting.
Yes, and so that's a challenge on a different front, but I'm excited about the piece.
And you seem really undaunted by so many technical challenges that would daunt the average pianist.
Oh, I am daunted.
Well, you don't show it. You hide it very well.
I am, yeah.
So this is on Monday night, October the 6th at 7:30 p.m. in Thompson Recital Hall, a great program brought to you by Mei Pong. You won't want to miss it. And thanks for coming in to chat about it.
Thank you.
Our residency with the artist from Fifth House Ensemble continues this week, and by some strange alignment of the planets, the husband and wife team that is a part of Fifth House Ensemble actually got to be in the same zip code for a few days. Coming in to chat with me in the studio are Eric and Melissa Snoza. Welcome.
Hi.
Hello. So that's pretty cool for once, because normally we get one of you but not both, and one of you is somewhere and the other one's somewhere else. So part of this conversation probably ought to be about how a husband and wife team keep it together when you have a schedules like you do.
Oh my gosh. It is a really interesting balance. And you know, a lot of people are alternately really excited by and then horrified to learn that we work together as much as we do. And I think one of the funniest stories we had on that was when we first started doing a lot of work from home. I thought, oh, this is going to be so great. We're going to, you know, share an office and all of this stuff is going to be so awesome.
Not quite the way it worked out, is
no,
it?
No. We work on opposite sides of the house. We instant message each other from the same building.
It's a little scary.
It's just our work styles are different, but it's really cool to have the opportunity to travel together and to do the things we love to do.
One of the benefits of being married and why we've been married so long is that we complement each other very well. So whereas Melissa comes from a background and an idea that's very focused and regimented and scheduling and things like that, I come from the opposite end of the spectrum, which is more out of the box thinking and craziness. But when you combine these two forces together, you get something that I think is pretty great.
Right, because I have to say that I'm a type A personality and Melissa makes me look bad. So I think putting those two forces together, the sum is greater than the whole of its parts.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So for this rare moment, you get to be in the same zip code. Here you are working together on this. And tell me what you're up to this week.
Great. So we have a number of things that we're doing this week. We have a session with the orchestra where we're bringing in one of our favorite guests to talk about Kickstarter. His name is Kevin Clark, and he's the communications manager for New Music USA.
Mm-hmm.
And he's always been a wonderful resource to us in terms of crowdfunding and all of those things. So we're really looking forward to that.
Is he Skyping in?
He is.
This is terrific. So let me bring our audience up to speed. So as you probably know, our orchestra is on tour in Vienna this winter term. So they'll be in Vienna in January. And we have this opportunity to perform in maybe the greatest house of all, the Musikverein. And in order to advertise and make that space happen, we need to raise some money to make that a really successful concert. We actually cut it in a line item edit of the budget because we couldn't make it happen. And then we decided maybe we can get this back in via a Kickstarter program. And we decided we'd call upon our Kickstarter experts. And so that was you to us. And you've called on your Kickstarter experts to really bring this together. And you're actually going to present this idea to the orchestra today.
Exactly. And I think Kevin's really wonderful. I think one of my favorite things about his perspective is he doesn't just share what makes a successful Kickstarter go. He also is really great at explaining why Kickstarter programs are so important and what it means to build support for a project that's not just financial and why that's so huge. So I think that that's a really great thing that he's going to be able to bring in that session.
Great 21st century musician skill.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, what else?
So we also have a session in which we're going to be training students on how to do public speaking, which most people would not realize that the fear of public speaking is more prevalent than the fear of death.
Right, that's true. And you know, it's interesting to me the number of musicians who are drawn to music and scared to death to be on the stage, but they just love music. So stage fright's very, very common in musicians.
The biggest thing we found from talking to musicians, professional musicians, is once you remove the instrument from their hands, they become naked in a sense.
Yeah, right. And they're lost.
Exactly.
And yet I've watched both of you do presentations in this residency, and it seems like you're perfectly at ease when that happens.
Well, I will say this, that is a learned mechanism for me. Mm-hmm. Stage fright was a huge part of my life, and public speaking, you know, even the idea of calling someone to order a pizza was terrifying for me. This is not a joke, and most people are really surprised to learn that now that they're seeing me on this end of it.
Right.
So that's one of the things that has made it really gratifying for me to teach that to other people, is that this is a learned mechanism. This is something that I had to get over in my life.
Right, and Eric, doesn't seem like your problem.
You know, I was born without that fear for some reason. I love talking to people.
Right.
So, yeah. But I love sharing some of the secrets that I use. And when I look introspectively about how I do that, it's basically turning a lot of those emotions that we perceive as fear and anxiety into something else.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And we'll be talking more about that.
Yeah, I know when I took Myers-Briggs and came out as an introvert, everyone's like, oh, you took it wrong. No, I told the truth. And the truth is I'm very introverted, but you learn these skills that you have to learn to do what you do.
Absolutely.
So that's going to be a great session. Mm-hmm. Anything else while you're here?
Yes.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Yes. So we also are visiting the entrepreneurship course, and we're going to be talking about print materials that pop. So one thing that your listeners may not know about Eric is that he's a very accomplished photographer, and he leads a very successful photography studio in Chicago.
Yeah, we should remind folks that Eric is the bassist in Fifth House Ensemble, and Melissa is the flautist. That means she plays the flout in the in the Fifth House Ensemble, but also bring other skills to it as well, and photography is one of Eric's.
Yes, I run a Snow Studios Photography, SNO Studios Photography, back in Chicago, where we do everything from weddings to headshots to events.
And it was your photo that was on the giant banner we had hanging last year in the rotunda here.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was Fifth House that actually got me started with photography. I had done photo editing and things in the past. But when it came time to get headshots for our entire group, at the time our budget wasn't high enough to be able to get individual headshots for everybody plus a whole group shot. So we had to find other ways of doing that. So at the time, I was like, well, we could purchase the equipment and I could give this a try and see how it turns out. And Melissa said, well, great. And
if, necessity is the mother of invention.
Absolutely. And Melissa said, if the photos suck, we can just return the equipment.
So don't stink at this.
No, yes. Don't stink. Yeah. But I had a lot of fun. And so that's why I started the company.
Good.
Yeah. So, you know, that session is really going to be focused on how to get a great photo, whether you're doing it yourself or whether you're hiring a photographer. We're also going to be focusing on how to build a really wonderful bio and then bringing those things together into some really wonderful print materials, which Eric also has a lot of experience in graphic design. And I know that Suzanne here is also an expert and a resource for students as well. So it's great to have the opportunity to have that conversation.
Sounds like we have a great few days in store.
Absolutely.
It's going to be a lot of fun.
Tons of conversations with individual students too, and that's what we're here to do.
Great. And then you'll be back next semester because you're actually, instead of being the frequent guest that you are this semester, you're actually going to be the professor in charge next semester of our practicum course.
I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, we are too.
Just turned in the syllabus last week.
I was reading it. Made me want to take the class. Well, thanks for coming in to chat about it. We've had a great year so far and a super one in store, and so I'm sure you'll be frequent guests here on Music for Life. We're glad you're here.
Looking forward to it.
From the Student Recital Hour of October 1st, 2014, soprano Shannon Berry and pianist John Clodfelter performed the aria En vain pour éviter from Georges Bizet's Carmen. Thank you.
Our Green Guest Artist Series continued last week with a phenomenal performance by string quartet Ethel and their guest Robert Mirabal, and we were able to take them from their busy lifestyles to come in and chat with me in the studio. First of all, welcome.
Thank you,
Thanks
Mark.
So much.
So let me start with the obvious question. String quartet Ethel. How do we get there?
We begin with an environment about 20 years ago where string quartets were still very universally accepted as a classical musical genre, and most of them were naming themselves after philosophers or schools of thought or something like that. You know, they had a very academic kind of leaning, and yet the cultural environment was shifting very quickly towards a more blended universal style, and we were creatures of that. Mm-hmm. And what we wanted was something that had no ideological framework. And yeah,
and you got it.
Right. We really did. We nailed it.
So who came up with it?
One of our original members, one of the violinists, a woman called Mary Rowell, who has a wonderfully dry Vermont sense of humor, and walked in one day reminding us of the movie Shakespeare in Love, where Shakespeare is caught on the horns of a dilemma. He has a commission he has to complete, but he hates the working title, which is Romeo and Ethel the Pirate's Daughter.
Perfect.
Yes.
So when you refer to yourselves now, does it just appear as Ethel only, or does it appear in some way identifying it as a string quartet? Is it simply, do you prefer that?
It is an issue. You want people to be able to understand what you are, but we did want it to have a simple, familiar, you know, family name kind of effect. So when we publicize ourselves, as far as we can, we use just the name.
That's fantastic. And is it always in all caps?
Yeah, that happened about a decade ago or something. It just showed up, and and then it became what we did. Actually,
Ralph really hates E.E. Cummings.
Oh, so this is the antithesis
yes.
of E.E. Cummings,
right?
Yes,
so not true. I adore E.E. Cummings. There was actually, it may have come because we have, I think, are still possibly the only string quartet out there with tattoos, temporary tattoos. To give away, so some of your, I think you've probably been seeing some of those running around campus this
already.
Past week or so, mm-hmm. right? And you'll see on the tattoo, I see you're not wearing yours today.
I'm working on it.
It's the heart with the name Ethel, like a
yeah,
mom tattoo.
Yeah.
And that is all caps. That Ethel is all caps. And that actually was our original, the very first record we released in 2002, I believe it was. That graphic came from that. So that was all caps then. So maybe it just sort of became how it happened at that point. And it really has been all caps since.
Since, yeah. Very effective.
Thank you.
So here at DePauw, we've been spending years trying to develop a new curriculum and new ways of creating the 21st century musician, which addresses a lot of the things that Ethel does. You know, that we're trying to get away from this idea that string quartets only play the music of dead white Germans, and it's always the same thing over and over again, you know, that we're kind of breaking out of the mold a bit. You guys have been at this for quite a while. This is, how many years has Ethel been in existence?
This is our 17th season.
17 seasons.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And you also do a wide variety of things. You know, you just recently performed for us on stage, but you're also heavily involved in your own community and in other communities. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
One of the most rewarding associations that Ethel has is with budding composers, specifically Native American student composers in the Navajo and Hopi nations, as well as the Salt River, Pima, Maricopa communities.
Mm-hmm.
And high school kids, through the Native American Composers Apprenticeship Program, write string quartets. We come in, we play them, and everyone feels great about music. Mm-hmm. It's one of the more fun things you can do. To change the way that people view each other.
Right.
You know, two students are sitting there. One day it's just, you know, me and you, and the only thing we do together is we sit at home and play video games and waste time. And then some, you know, Wednesday comes around and suddenly you've written a string quartet. You're a composer. This ensemble from New York has just crossed the country to come and learn
play
and perform
your music.
Your string quartet. And I thought you were just this dude who I could beat at my favorite video game.
Right.
Assassin's Creed 2, was that the one? Yes. One of the composers.
But for the themes. I mean,
yeah,
this was really interesting.
He mined the themes.
Yeah, he plays it for the music.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to use that.
Actually, we had a student on Music for Life last year who was writing the theme music for a video game. And, you know, now we see orchestras all the time. Tonight's
yeah.
video game
yeah.
music. You know, we'll reach out in any way that we can. So did that relationship lead to your relationship with Robert Mirabal?
Or is that just a happy coincidence?
In a way, our relationship with Robert came out of that. So we have been going to the Southwest for 10 years now. And just as that program was starting to become part of what we did, it really started to feel like home for us, we developed this program called Truck Stop, which was a community celebration program.
So fantastic.
Thank you. And that was all about being together with other artists, seekers and connectors, making music with them, listening to their work, sharing our work with them, jamming with them, going to potlucks with them, hanging out in their communities, bringing them to our communities, and ultimately building hybrid programs together. This was something that came out of the spirit of our work at NACAP. It was greatly informed by that, and our very first truck stop was, in fact, with the father of one of our NACAP students in 2006. We were in the living room of the amazing poet and activist and actor and singer James Biligoodie. And we showed up at his house one day because his daughter said, hey, come on over. My dad's a singer. And that sparked this whole world for us. And so that was 2006. And I believe it was just about a year after that, we were going to Albuquerque. And Dorothy opened a door for us.
We reached out. We were inspired by this idea that music is a language, but it eschews ideologies. Mm-hmm. And we built a show for the Brooklyn Academy of Music to demonstrate that as far as we could, and approached four master artists from across the country, from communities as diverse as we could think of. And we did inform ourselves about the communities out in the Southwest and received, I think the fact is that Robert is the primary performer of this global music mix in that whole area. And he was the very first name to come to us. And we approached him, and thank God he was willing. He was interested. Had all the skills that anybody ever needs to open oneself up to collaborations in music. And he was actually one of the most powerful forces in developing that program because he could converse and relate and create a kind of an empathic channel with everybody in that setting. So it's a real honor and a delight to say that this is a friendship that has lasted and we continue to play.
And how many years have you been performing?
This is now 8 years later, right? I think it's 8 years since we built that first program.
Wow.
Yeah.
So typically a string quartet comes to be known and you have this expectation they're going to play their thing and we know to expect this is... But if people came to Ethel 1 week and... a month later, came to Ethel again. It could be so totally different. I mean, you guys are just fearless, and you're out there doing so many different things. Does that make you, I'm not schizophrenic, and neither am I? Or
expect Brilliant. The unexpected.
Yeah, I love that you say we're fearless. I think there's plenty of fear involved. It's not like I'm shattering my teeth or anything, but it is pretty... daunting, the things we take on every once in a while. Like, whoa, that's happening next week. And then everybody crams and figures out how to shift their lives so that we can have the 47 hours in a day and a half of rehearsal that we need. But I suppose, it's not fear. There's a lot of incredible excitement in diving.
You're living on the edge.
It's a huge joy. Yeah. It really is. And I think it also rests on a tremendous amount of trust.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's
developed over a long period of time.
Right. Well, tried. We've certainly worked it so many times that we have a fair degree of security that by investing real faith in each other and in the people that you approach, you get the best out of them, and it's always worth it.
Right. And just sort of a willing edge to say yes to everything thrown our way, because I think that limiting ourselves would take away from so many explorations we would have never seen coming. So saying yes to things that we don't understand on every facet or every level, I think could prevent us from coming into so many elements that now we use to define ourselves all the time.
That was so beautiful, Tamara. There's one great thing about that I love, and this came from a professor of mine way back when I was in conservatory, dear old friend, Dr. Joel Sachs. He had been approached, I think, in earlier years by classical music fans who were worried that all this time he was spending playing contemporary music was going to somehow harm his classical work. And he always chuckled at that. And he's a brilliant performer and incredible teacher and much loved by so many folks across the world and in the new music community, especially. He chuckled at that, and he laid down the law for me right then and there, and I'm this young punk at 19 or something, and he said, you know, every single thing you do is going to inform everything else you do. There's a little bit of something that you're going to be able to take away from your every musical experience, your every life experience, that is going to bring new power, new depth, new joy to every new thing you take on. So if I'm playing Garigliano, that's going to do something to my Mozart,
right,
and that's a great thing. Likewise, if I'm playing Bach, that's going to do something to my Dorothy Lawson piece that I'm now taking on, which is kicking my butt.
From a certain perspective, isn't that just sort of admitting to the detractor that they're right, though? Like, in not to play the... I mean, to play the devil's advocate.
To play the devil's advocate.
Like, so they're saying to Jill Sachs, you're playing all this...
Right here.
you're playing all this new music, you're playing Carigliano, you're playing, you know, whatever, a lot of Davidovsky, and suddenly your Bach sounds like a whole bunch of bleeps and bloops and, like, cinema music. You know, it's like...
It's never that singular, though. It's never a one-way transference.
Right,
right?
But isn't that kind of funny?
Yes, and your Carigliano begins to benefit from your knowledge of Bach.
True,
and
sure, of course. But I think it's funny that, like, this guy who was attacking your teacher, and then you're defending your teacher by saying his response, but really his response is, you're right, but it's a good thing.
Well, I think it's more a reawakening of the Renaissance musician, where every musician is not just a master of their instrument, but also a singer and a composer and an entrepreneur.
You bring a great point. We had Roomful of Teeth here last month.
Oh,
Caroline
Saul was
in doing a...
We love them.
Yeah, aren't they fantastic? And amazing. Caroline came in, and we were chuckling about the fact that people are saying, boy, this is all the new thing. Actually, it's the old thing. It's
fine.
We finally got it back.
Yeah.
The day of the performing specialist is kind of dying, and the day of we're musicians here.
Right.
This is what we do.
Right.
Has come back to life. And, you know, it's funny. You mentioned this idea about the conservatory, which... I used to say there's a reason it starts with conserve. Now I think they could probably be called preservatories. But the, there is this thing where we really think, like, if we don't do it the way Bach did it, you know, it's sacrilege or something. When did it start for you that, you know, because you all classically trained musicians, suddenly going, you know, there's just, I'm okay with the fact that I'm not going to spend my entire life in a powdered wig.
That's a wonderful way to put it. Well, one of the things about this quartet that I find personally extremely, it's beautifully illuminating for exactly that kind of awareness. We are four generations. We have a member in our 20s, a member in the 30s, a member in the 40s, a member in the 50s. And as the oldest, I would say that I look back and I think exactly to that that mindset that I carried out of school. I knew very clearly what my assigned repertoire was going to be. I knew how to play it. I knew, you know, I knew who I was going to play it with. I knew what the performance mode looked like.
Right.
And it's all gone. It's all changed. And I'm so happy. I am so grateful for that, because I, at this point, looking back, I wouldn't have had nearly the joy or the sense of investment in it that I do now. I think it looks so very different to people who were born, you know, much, much more recently. Those are battles that were kind of fought and won maybe 25 years ago, you know. And the kids don't have to, I apologize for saying kids, but, you know, younger people don't have to engage with that the same way, and they shouldn't.
Right.
It's not like every generation should revisit the same issues.
Exactly. And the hierarchical nature of music is a it's a, just a false step in my that this music is the real music and what this other
No.
The fact is that music speaks to people in incredibly powerful ways, and it's different music in different people, but it's all music.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
And that's really important. So have you always you guys amplify?
Mostly and, generally, yeah.
And did you start that way?
Yes.
Yes.
What prompted that?
It was interesting. We at the very beginning, we ended up having to defend that, too, because of the world we were coming from. But pretty quickly, it came clear it was actually a timbral discussion for us. We were looking at creating colors and exploring different sounds and spaces. There were two very practical considerations as well, one being this is a sound and a spirit and a vibe that's in a lot of performance space today that really resonates for us, and we want to be part of that. Also, we were playing a lot of work with track and doing work that was designing live sound in space. Mm-hmm. Both of those things you must amplify to have effective presentation, especially when you're dealing with track. If you have pre-recorded work and then you're not actually amplified, you're not going to have a blend of sound.
Right.
So we were out to create our own sound from the start, and it was never a volume issue. And that discussion went away very quickly.
That's excellent. It's really not a volume issue. It's a timbral choice.
It's a timbral choice.
And it's a fantastic one, I have to say. How'd you do it? You know, I mean, so, you know, it's like, well, I'll try it on this microphone.
You want to talk about that, Kip? Our tech director, Kip Jones.
it's always a work in progress. I think we've actually made great strides in this department since over the last couple of years. I've been in the band for 2.5 years now. There was a little bit of a tech switch when I joined, so I'm not sure exactly what the old regime was. Mm-hmm. But we've got an endorsement with Beyerdynamic, and they give us microphones, which we love. We spend way too much money buying expensive pickups, which we also love. Now we have these fantastic little TC Helicon blending boxes that allow us to insert effects from stage. Right.
Are you sitting in your apartment going, let's see that?
Kip spends his weekends.
Unfortunately, when the division of labor in a situation like this, only one of us has to actually do the hard work of deciding, like, that's too much gain, that's too much low-end gain, that's way too much high-end gain, so on and so forth. I'm going to dial this in a specific way. But one of the commissions that's coming to us, can I talk about it? Is that okay?
Absolutely,
yes. Public? So Missy Mazzoli is writing us a quartet. And we're going to premiere it next February at Miller Hall.
We just signed an agreement with New Amsterdam, so maybe we'll have you guys back.
Nice. It's going to be a phenomenal piece, and she's specifically writing it for not just an amplified string quartet, but an amplified string quartet that is fluent in modulating aspects of their signal, you know, through the course of a piece. What that's exactly going to entail, we don't know. I mean, we've been talking back and forth about harmonizers and delays and octaves and so on. But the fact of the matter is that we've somewhat successfully managed to co-opt an aspect of timbral control that to this point has only been reserved for rock bands. And it's pretty cool to bring that into the fold. I mean, I've always felt that there are many things very similar about the performance of rock music and classical music as opposed to folk music and jazz, which are far more form-driven and far more, they're very conceptual. You have to understand what's happening in this piece and why people are making the decisions they're making and so on and so forth. And why is it a banjo now? Why is it a mandolin now? And so on. Whereas with rock music and classical music, the composer makes a specific decision or a band makes a set of decisions. And then musicians go through the process of making those decisions again in a very specific order in a very specific time frame to create an impression to the audience or to create a specific feeling. This kind of steals from rock music one of those through composed modalities.
Right.
And we haven't gotten there yet. We haven't dove in. But it's going to be both powerful. We haven't gotten in there yet. But it's, I can't imagine that it'll be anything other than powerful and effective. And just, you know, one more blurring of the lines of what a genre of music used to be.
You guys are so ear and eye and mind opening when you perform, and that's what I love about you.
Oh, thank you.
So one of the great things about this radio show is that I get to bring all these great people in, you know, and I talk to them, and I'm like, oh, well, we got 4 minutes for this interview, and 2 hours later we're going, oh, well, did we make it into the time slot? So I get to talk with people who are very long into their careers and can look back at this amazing, and other people who've just kind of started and had some early successes. When you're back in 20 years and we're talking
we're coming.
We got your book
And
we're talking about success, how will you define it?
How
2034
we want to talk about how what people know when they talk about Ethel. What's that going to be?
Wow. I would hope that we would, as well as building this body of work that we have followed our hearts to create, that we will be people, and we will be in a place where we fully acknowledge and celebrate that. I hope that we also participate in the similar empowerment and growth of a new generation of players who start where we are and take it way, way further.
That's great, because you think about what Ethel has done. Our idea of a string quartet pre-Ethel and our idea post-Ethel, two different ideas in radical ways, and you guys have made that happen, and I'm thrilled you spent some time on our campus and shared with us all, and I really appreciate the time you've taken out today to chat about it.
Thank you so much.
From their performance in Kresge Auditorium on October 2nd, 2014, Ethel performs Arrival by Marcello Zarvos.
We've had an incredible week here in the DePauw School of Music with a fantastic performance by Ethel and a very special guest that I am thrilled is joining me in the studio to chat for a moment. It is my great pleasure to welcome to Music for Life, Robert Mirabal. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
So it's really hard to define any person. They do so many things. But in your case, it's particularly interesting because as a composer and as a teacher and a performer and a leader in so many ways, you're so involved in so many different things. Do you rank those? Is there an order of I'm a flute player? No, I'm actually a composer first. The main thing I do is, or is it just all of those?
When I was a few years younger, I consider myself a musician, composer. Mm-hmm. But in the last 5 years, I really have gone back to my roots, and I was born and raised on Taos Pueblo, mm-hmm. in the small little village of 2,000 people. And I grew up a farmer. I was born and raised to be a farmer. Mm-hmm. I was taken care of by my grandma and grandpa. And so that's what I did. And farmed all traditional crops. And so the last 5 years, I really have committed myself to that. Into going back to that, to the roots of my cultures, my traditions, the language, the ceremonies and everything mm-hmm. like that. And as I look back now, I think it's all related. Mm-hmm. Me being an actor, me being a farmer, me being a musician. Mm-hmm. Some people put too many different barriers. And to me, it's just all connected. And what I do in the farms and in the fields has made me a better composer mm-hmm. and a better musician too, and much more patient with people like Ethel.
So there's a really beautiful symmetry to that it's come full circle, and you've started there and you're returning to that. What took you from farming to music? How did that transition take place?
There was a whole connection. My grandpa was a dancer, and so for many, many years he traveled as a young man, just getting in his horse and going up to Cimarron and catching the train in Raton with a little valise of regalia and a shovel in one hand. And he ended up in the Midwest, in Kansas, Oklahoma, parts of Colorado. Mm-hmm. And so he ended up in a salt mine and met a lot of the Cheyenne and the people from northern Oklahoma. And so he spent a lot of time there. Mm-hmm. And so he came back home basically really connected to the song and the dance of the Southern Plains people. And that was just a typical thing that, I mean, he was one of the first sons of five uncles. Mm-hmm. So that's what they did. I would always hear him talk about different stories that he had. And so maybe that was the little spark and the little key to mm-hmm. form. So I would hear songs and dance. And growing up on the Pueblo, that's typical. Mm-hmm. You connect making moccasins to the farming, to the corn dancing, to the deer dancing, to the buffalo dancing. So it's all fused together. And within that, you become the tailor to the making of the regalia. And then you go into the language. And as the older you get, you go beyond just the conversational part of the language. Mm-hmm. So you start to solidify yourself from the simple form of communication into the traditional form mm-hmm. of communication and initiation rituals and things like that. And so it becomes a huge theatricality inside your brain. Mm-hmm. And so for me to go from that to out here, I was much more connected, I guess, to the colorfulness and the expression of theater and music and improvisation as well as collaboration.
So did you teach yourself first?
Yeah.
And you just learned it on your own?
Yeah. Yeah.
And was there a method for you, or did you just, I'm going to explore this as an individual?
I was probably about 12 or 13. I danced with a professional dance troupe, and we collaborated with a group that was called Ayahuacan, and they were an Ecuadorian group. Hmm. And so we did a tour in the Southwest called Los Americas, and it was the three Americas mm-hmm. and their particular music. And so at 13, at one of the last shows in Arizona, this one of the performers of the Ecuadorian group gave me a ocarina. Looked like a little carrot or something. And so I started dabbling in playing music from, you know, it was in a pentatonic minor scale. Uh-huh. And so all that time, I had never seen a, quote, typical Native American flute of this hemisphere. I'd heard stories of men playing these instruments, but never seen it. and I'd seen him in like museums, but I never touched it or really.
Right.
And so we have our own traditional instruments that are played just by certain men during the certain times of pollination, when the corn pollinates.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the harvest, that's when those instruments are played. And so I slowly started to dabble at that. But I went out to be an actor. I wanted to be an actor. But then I did a lot of summer stock and did some commercials and, you know, simple things like that. And then I came home and I bought a flute.
A traditional Native American flute.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And it just so happened that it was made by an old timer that was from my grandpa's society. That was the last flute he made. And I never knew that he made flutes. And it was a last flute that he made. And so that's where I taught myself how to play. And he passed away that year. And I came back from summer stock. I didn't have a dollar in my pocket. So I split it in half. And then I got another piece of cedar wood. And I started carving it out.
Wow.
And I taught myself how to make these instruments.
So from early on, and I mean, right away, you were making it at the same pace at which you were learning it.
Yeah. You know, I grew up in a, you know, I mean, when you're the minority of a minority, you do two things. You either run from the main majority of the system, or you immerse yourself into the system and become kind of amalgamated.
Mm-hmm.
What I did is I read. I read anything that I possibly could so I could basically BS my teachers.
Mm-hmm.
But it was one of those things where that was my survival instinct, was to perform. It was my way of rebellion instead of fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I fought a lot because it's still, to some certain extent, in northern New Mexico, pretty brutal. But when I was growing up in the mid to late 80s, it was still kind of like you had to be very careful.
Mm.
So there's still that little edge of, well, you're Indian, you're from the Pueblo, they're either afraid of you or they want to beat you up.
Right.
So what I did is I started performing. I started creating. I went beyond all that, started studying acting, started studying theater, script writing, how to stage a particular show and things like that. And while I was doing that, I was really influenced by a huge array of musical talent that I was interested in, everything from just your basic 70s rock and roll. And then about that time, world music started coming in. And then since I was already influenced by South American and Central American music, I went farther than that and started studying stuff that was coming out of Africa, India, the Caribbeans, you know, different things like that. And one thing led to another, and I started to get really fascinated by collaboration and how I could incorporate the musical instruments that I was making into mainstream. I had no idea. I mean, I had played drums and studied drums and rhythm and things like that, but I didn't understand melody per se as well. I knew that if this was an E major, then I could probably play a C minor, but I didn't understand all those little different theories. But I kept on going, kept on pursuing what I thought was musically feeding my soul.
And it's interesting because your experiences in the dramatic world and in theater and as an actor have influenced heavily your musical performance.
It's
almost part and parcel.
Yeah, I ended up in the last 10 years, you know, creating some really amazing pieces. I worked with three different shows at the same time on PBS. One of them was my own show called Music from a Painted Cave. And that particular show was based on the theatrical motions of one person starting from a traditional aspect musically. It's kind of like a native opera and going from one level of musicianship to theatricality of the simplicity of just the flute, the movement, the soul of the piece into a full-blown collaborative rock musicians fused in with traditional native dancers and things like that. It was brutal because the demand of spirituality, especially in this country, is pretty immense. I didn't understand it as much. I thought everybody was still kind of like, they were okay in their own world. But then what I was bringing into my own particular form of music was a sense of spiritual inspiration. And then that brings me, you know, years and years. I mean, I won 2 Grammys in those particular years of just composing music that was based on that spiritual inspiration. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of got watered down as the years went by because of there's this, you know, you see some, everybody gets on the bandwagon and starts to change their name. You know, Douglas Johnson becomes Douglas White Feather or something right. like that. Yeah. So it, right. so it, I kind of shied away and started to do a lot more conscious music, music that I thought, well, if I'm going to be 80 years old, what music do I want to play? And then that's when the collaboration with Ethel began. Mm-hmm. They are, I don't collaborate with too many people anymore. Mm-hmm. And these guys take me out of my farm, mm-hmm. take me out of my village and my people. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're in the middle of a harvest ceremony today. Is actually the last day of a 5-day ceremony. Hmm. I was in ceremony just 2 days ago, get on a plane to meet Ethel, and my brothers and my sisters at the Pueblo are also right now, right as we speak, in ceremony, creating and pushing and putting the lid, as they say, on the last of the harvest ceremonial season. Wow. So I live a completely, and I've never left the culture of the Pueblo. Mm-hmm. And so what I do with Ethel is create ceremony on stage. I create an inspirational mm-hmm. ceremony on stage mm-hmm. with musicians that go beyond themselves but are highly trained so that they can feel what the spiritual motion mm-hmm. is in certain times. And so I've really, really, in the last 4 to 5 years, have really, really felt a stronger connection within my own music through working with people that have barely ever seen the connection to Pueblo ceremony. Mm-hmm. And it's been fascinating for me.
And there's a beauty in your music and your performance that is very natural. It connects us back to the earth, and it's grounded. There's no airs being put on here. This is a very powerful and moving experience. So tonight, there'll be a lot of folks here that know your music and are here as part of that, and there'll be a lot of people that will be exposed to it for the first time. When they're walking away, what is it that you hope? Because your music is so deep and it is yeah. so layered. What is it that you hope they walk out with?
The show that we did the other night was based on reincorporating a choir. Mm-hmm. And this whole show is based around agriculture. Mm-hmm. And it's based around music that has been composed around the element of the sun, the moon, the stars, and the movement, and the push from the seed to the beginning, to the end, when we harvest.
When the harvest, uh-huh.
And so what we've created is that music has no boundaries and no barriers. And I think in life, we create too many barriers. Mm-hmm. And so I want people to walk away, as they walk away, feeling inspired, feeling that there is a question beyond what they have been living, but to be inspired beyond that. And every show that I've done in the last 5 years, I've put a little bag of seeds so that people who are inspired come up and pick up a seed and take the seed, save it, and then they plant it in the springtime. And these seeds are from my world, ancient seeds, nothing genetically modified. And so I consider that to be kind of like a metaphor of how life can evolve into one place to the next. But I'm really particular about not overwhelming the people or the audience like, oh, he's Indian. I want to be a musician with them. Mm-hmm. And they give me the freedom to really shine as a guest artist with them. Mm-hmm. So I'm really proud to be with them on tour.
You know, there's an old saying that says music washes away the dust of everyday life. But in your music, I feel that it celebrates the dust of everyday life. We're celebrating who we are and what we are, and we're tied much more closely to it. There's a kind of ineffable, holistic approach to what we're witnessing when we see you perform. And that is especially true with Ethel. And I feel that we have been doubly blessed this week to have both you and Ethel on our campus and on our stage. And I appreciate the time you've taken to chat with us about it.
Right on. Thanks.
From their performance in Kresge Auditorium on October 2nd, 2014, Robert Mirabal Ethel and DePauw's chamber singers perform Mirabal's piece, En Canard.
We hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of Music for Life. We love hearing from listeners. You can contact us by emailing musicforlife@depauw.edu. We're also on Facebook at DePauw Music for Life, and you can subscribe to our show on iTunes by searching there for DePauw Music for Life. Our student producers are Anna Gatdula, Matt Skiba, Burke Stanton, Rachel Amalfitano, and Hannah Gauthier. Our 21CM graduate intern is Elika Okerstrom. Veronica Pedrell is our online editor, and our show is produced by Matthew Champagne in the Judson and Joyce Green Center for the Performing Arts at DePauw University in Greencastle, Indiana. I'm Mark McCoy, Dean of the School of Music. Thank you for listening to our show. Keep music in your life, and have a great week.
It's Music for Life.